So you may wonder why I had Revelation read. We'll get there. Yep. Right now, we are going to look at Leviticus 21 and 22. In chapters 21 and 22, we transition from the summary chapters that we talked about last week as we started the second half of the book, the whole holiness code of 17 to 27. We talked about the last two of the first four summary chapters. And we saw that these summary chapters are given to the people. But then in this book of Leviticus, directed primarily to the Levites or the priests, we see that the rest of the book play out primarily, honestly, looking through the lens of the priests. And it is no surprise then that in these first two chapters, they are directed directly to the priests. And then going forward from there, you're going to have feasts and Sabbaths and things about the tabernacle, all of which do apply to the whole people. But the priests specifically are going to be in charge of these things. In 21 to 22, we are going to see a discussion on things the priests can or cannot do, restrictions they have, and also we're going to see a discussion on acceptable offerings that applies to anybody who brings an offering. These chapters are, honestly, unpleasant at first glance. Especially in our culture, they seem exclusive, sexist, or even unloving at times. They speak of priests not being able to attend the funeral of their relatives, women being considered unfit for marriage, and handicapped people being rejected from sacred space. So again, how are we getting to Revelation 21? Especially, again, in our culture, and especially if you are reading these chapters as an unbeliever who doesn't understand much about God to begin with, it is not difficult to walk away with the feeling that God is uncaring, unforgiving, and uninviting when you read these chapters. They, and even we, may wonder how this same God is also the God who sent his Son to the poor and the needy and the sick, and who called all who are weary and burdened to himself. And how is this the same God who sent his Son, who healed the multitudes and the handicapped, who forgave adulterers and harlots and thieves and tax collectors? This seeming disconnect is understandable, but it ultimately only shows that we do not understand what is going on back here in Leviticus, and how even these chapters point forward to the work of Christ and God's plan to make all things new. So let's look at this holiness code for the priests and think about what messages are being given and how these chapters point forward. So as we look at Leviticus 21 and chapter 22, the first thing that I want you to do is just look at the chapter as a whole. Now, your Bible probably, as most, breaks it up into paragraphs. Look at the beginning and end of each paragraph. These are the brackets. You will notice that there is an audience that is specified. And then there's also a conclusion given at each one from the speaker, being God. So in each section, depending on what you're looking at as you glance through, you're going to see that it is directed to the priests, maybe, or maybe just Aaron, or maybe the priests and Aaron and the people. And at the end of each section, you're going to see some sort of variant of, I am the Lord who sanctifies them. You see kind of a build here of who is talking to. At the beginning and end, you have more of a general address. The beginning is to the priests in general. The end is to the priests and the people. And then between that, you have the priests in general. And then the high priest is kind of sandwiched in the middle. You got some direction to him specifically. So it kind of starts general, gets specific, and goes back to general. But then throughout all of this, you have the same conclusion, I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Now I want you to look at 21, the end of verse 7 into 8, because I want to talk a little bit about directly with this conclusion, how God ends each section. So as you look at 7, they shall not marry a prostitute or a woman who has been defiled, neither shall they marry a woman divorced from her husband. Why? For the priest is holy to his God. You shall sanctify him, for he offers the bread of your God, which is kind of a idiom or cultural way of saying he enters the presence of God. For the bread was called the bread of the presence. It was kind of a shorthand way of saying that. He shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord, who sanctify you or who make you holy. I am holy. So in here we have a longer description that is then kind of usually briefly summarized at the end of the sections going forward, where it's shortened to, I am the Lord who sanctifies him, them, whoever the audience is, or makes them holy. In here, in these two verses especially, but in the conclusion of every section, we have the meaning of each section and the main message behind each section. Priests are held to a higher level of holiness, not because they are better. They, as people, are not morally superior or on better ground with God. They aren't like first-rate Christians and everybody else is second-rate Christians. That is not what this is about at all. It's easy to read these sections and walk away with that. But it is not so much about the priests, but about God and his presence. The restrictions are upped according to how close of access they have to the presence of God. So it's more about God than about them. It is God, their proximity to his presence, his holy ground, that sanctifies them or makes them holy by setting them apart. In other words, their holiness, which again, as we've talked about many times, is not necessarily, strictly speaking, morality, but about how set apart they are, how different they have to be and look and dress and anything. How set apart they are is in accordance to how set apart the ground they walk on is. Feet on normal ground can wear sandals. Feet on holy ground must take those sandals off. Sandals are not bad, but there is a message that is being given by this distinction of what is going on which type of ground. The rules get more restrictive as one gets closer to the Holy of Holies because the point is to teach about who God is, how he created the world, and how the world will again be one day. These rules aren't a double standard because they aren't actually about the person at all. They are about God. Rules about access and inclusion were never designed to divide the people into classes or give the impression that some people were second-rate Israelites. Rather, they were solely a statement about God, not the people. Banning priests, as we will see, with defects from serving in the presence, or banning women who aren't virgins, and prohibiting them from marriage to the priests, especially the high priest, or banning women who are widows, and all these different categories that we'll see as we walk through, these are not making a moral statement about these people per se, but rather a statement about God, similar to the message behind banning leaven in offerings. Leaven is good, helpful, and needed in baking, but it is banned from offering to give a theological message. So too, what we have in these chapters is theological messaging. These chapters were not meant to make people feel guilty or broken, or at least not leave them there. They were meant to make them feel hopeful as they see this picture of Eden in the lives and the conduct of the priests and are reminded that it is God who is making the priests and all his people holy and is working to restore Eden. It is a theological message of hope woven into each part of these chapters. So as we look to these chapters, I want to look at the first message that is given as we weave this message of hope. The first message we see is about God and his work of restoration as it has to do with death and his presence. We see this in verses 1 through 6 and 10 to 13. In these verses, we see that the priests are only allowed to make themselves unclean when the closest members of their family died, and the high priest was not even allowed this. There are a few explanations that are needed here. First, what does it mean to become unclean for the dead? That's a pretty cultural statement that we read that and we're like, I have no idea what that means as far as like how that relates to what I can and can't do when somebody that I know dies. We see later in Numbers 19 that becoming unclean for the dead means either entering a tent that the body is in or physically touching the corpse if it is outside of a tent. We also saw in Leviticus 11, 31 to 32, that uncleanness of a corpse is contagious and that not only anyone but also anything that comes into contact with it is made unclean. This is why you can't enter into a tent that has a dead body without becoming unclean, because effectively what is being communicated is everything within that tent has become unclean by contact in some way with that dead body. That's also why it gets even specific in Leviticus 11 about like any open container has to be washed, because if it wasn't sealed, then the contamination got into that vessel. So that was kind of the thinking behind this contamination process. This also explains why functionally these restrictions here in 21 meant and were practiced and applied as that the priest could only attend the funeral and the burial of the allowed family members. This was to avoid becoming unclean, even accidentally, by attending the funeral or the burial. Because again, with this, the view that the corpse was contagious, effectively, with uncleanness, means that if the priest did attend, there was a fairly high probability that he would even accidentally touch a person or a thing that had happened to be in contact at some point with that dead body. So he was not to risk that and not to attend the funeral or the burial, except for the people that were allowed to him. And you will see a difference here between the priest and the high priest of which people are allowed or not allowed. Second, and you may or may not have caught this, but when I read this, I was so confused why they didn't, like, why this one isn't in here, so I want to explain it a little bit. Why is the wife not mentioned as an exception? So you can read through verses 1 through 6 and 10 through 13. There is nothing about the wife. And the priests are allowed to marry, by the way. That's also one of the things we look at in these chapters. But this specifically becomes a question when you look at verse 4, because it is easy, especially in the ESV, to look at it and walk away like, well, I guess he's not allowed to even attend for his wife. Because verse 4 in the ESV says, he shall not make himself unclean as a husband among his people, and so profane his people. And this is immediately after being told he can't make himself unclean for the body of any relative beyond these set relatives, which for the priests are his parent, his brother or unmarried sister, or his children. Like, that's it, that the wife isn't mentioned in there. However, most other translations say something like, make himself unclean for people related to him by marriage. And this is a more accurate and helpful translation, because what's happening in the Hebrew there is the word that's being translated in ESV, as he should not make himself unclean as a husband, is basically more broad than that. It's actually pretty much as an in-law. Like anybody related to him by marriage, so like his wife's sister or like his wife's parent or anything like that, like anything related by marriage and not by blood, he would not be allowed to attend. A wife is obviously related by marriage, but Genesis 2:24 teaches that a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. In other words, a man leaves his closest relation to establish a new closest relation. To say then in verse 11 that the high priest cannot make himself unclean for even his father or mother says nothing about his relation, which is even closer, his wife. That the wife is an exception for the priest and the high priest is also defended by looking at Ezekiel 24, where Ezekiel, a priest, is told not to mourn his wife as a sign to the people. He would not have to be told this, and it would not be a sign to the people if he was already not allowed to mourn his wife. I see some confused looks. God tells Ezekiel that his wife is about to die that day, and he tells him not to mourn as a sign to the people that something precious to them, namely Jerusalem and the temple, is about to be destroyed, just like Ezekiel's wife, who is precious to him, is about to die. And basically, God is, in long story short, with the drama going on there, God is just attacking and kind of giving an accusation to people about their moral state. Like, they are not going to mourn what is happening to his holy place because they have so far gone in their rejection of him by this point. And what he's trying to communicate through having Ezekiel not mourn is the fact that, like, normally Ezekiel would be able to mourn. So, like, if he was barred from mourning, or from mourning, then this is different, and the people would notice that. And the people would ask him why, which is exactly what they do, which sets up for him explaining the drama that had just happened. And if he was already not allowed to do that, then they wouldn't have asked him why he didn't do it, because he wasn't supposed to do it. So again, by God telling Ezekiel to not mourn, he created this situation that allowed Ezekiel to be used as a teacher to the people through this sign that he was doing. And it was purposefully dramatic, purposefully the closest relation to Ezekiel, because God's temple is so intrinsically related and is his place of presence. So by having Ezekiel's closest relation pass away and not being able to mourn, God was showing that his closest, like, metaphorically relation, like his presence there with the people, wasn't being mourned. So again, getting back to the verses today, I would argue that for the priest and the high priest, the wife was an exception by default, because she is one flesh, his closest relative. He's barred from entering other people's tent, but he lives in the same tent with her. So by default, they don't have to mention her, because it's going to happen. He would be allowed to mourn her, is what I'm getting at. Kind of a convoluted argument there, but I just want to put that aside there, because at least for me, I was like, wait, what? Like, why can't he mourn her? That seems pretty tragic. So I would argue he is allowed to mourn. Third, what's going on with the restriction against making bald patches, shaving, or making cuts on their bodies in verse 5? So if you look at verse 5, they shall not make bald patches on their heads, nor shave off their edges of the beards, nor make any cuts on their body. Now again, by translation, you're going to see some variance there. The bald patches on the head, you could see either shaving or like marring or like ripping portions of the hair out. There's a variance there. That's because there's a semantic range of these words that are being used. And it pretty much bars any sort of marring or altering of the hair as a sign of mourning in any way. And why this would be important is that these restrictions, in their context, are barring certain pagan practices that were fairly common in their day. And by the way, if you look at verse 10, you read that the high priest wasn't even allowed to let his hair hang loose or tear his clothes, which were two of the even more basic forms of visible mourning. So like the priests, depending on their general priest or high priest, are barred from certain methods of mourning, but all priests in general are barred from these specific forms, which have to do with the hair and the beard and the cutting of the flesh. So what was the thinking specifically behind these restrictions, and how do they relate to maybe pagan practices that were going around? To understand them, we have to place them within their context. Here in chapter 21, we see clearly that these restrictions are set within a religious mourning context. We have just discussed who they can mourn, and now we are discussing how they can mourn. So these verses are within the mourning context. The priests have just been barred from going to the funeral or burial of certain people, in other words, like who they're allowed to mourn, and now as we transition into the next verses, we see how they can practice mourning when they are allowed to practice mourning. In Leviticus 19, 26 to 28, and then here in 21:5, and Deuteronomy 14:1, marring or cutting the hair or beard and cutting of the flesh are all grouped together. And in Leviticus 19 and forward in Deuteronomy 14:1, we also see the reference, because in those contexts it's not as clear that it's already within a mourning context. In those two other references, Leviticus 19, Deuteronomy 14, it's specified for the dead. Here they don't have to do that because it's already speaking about for the dead, so they didn't feel the need to add in that prepositional phrase. But all three contexts confirm that all of these practices have to do with mourning. They are prohibited because they were all common practices in pagan mourning rituals and that were done in an effort to offer some of one's own vitality and appease the spirit of the dead, or possibly to influence their fate through sacrifices on their behalf. And you think about that, like, how? So how this was done and the thinking behind here is that in the ancient thinking, and we've already talked about this a little bit, in the ancient thinking, blood was like a life force fluid. So that's why blood has all these meanings. You're not allowed to drink the blood because it symbolizes life, and God is the source of life. So we're aware of the blood symbolism. Hair was actually another symbolism, a symbolic thing that represented life force. So, in effect, what the priests are barred from doing is marring or sacrificing or offering part of their life force. And part of this is because, and we'll get into this a little bit later with all the defects and blemishes and the priests who have access and stuff, but the priests aren't to mar their vitality or their life force and then go and enter God's presence. Because if they do, they are entering God's presence in a state of unwholeness. They have disrupted their own wholeness or their own vitality. And if they do that, they would be temporarily banned until they were whole again from the presence of God, which gets back into all the uncleanness that we already worked through in different chapters about, like, when a woman is on menstruation, or when you have like body things going on, like, until you're whole again, you're barred from access to sacred space. So that's one of the reasons why that they can't do these things, is because it would create a bar to access to sacred space. But then also the association that is made in other cultures about how they are using these life forces. Because how it practically worked out in other cultures is basically they would shave off either completely or parts of their hair. They rip out their hair, their beard, or parts of it. And that would basically be them saying, I am giving part of my life force to this god that I am worshiping in an attempt to appease them so that they are in a better state of mind when this person that I know has died, or in an attempt to influence that person's fate. Like, maybe I knew they weren't the greatest person, but if we all just give enough of our life force, we can kind of pave the way for them to get in. And it could also be just a way of showing dedication to that god. None of these things were anything that God had told his people to do, and none of them reflected how his world actually works and how the eternal fate of each person works. You can't, like, give your own life force and save somebody else. So they're inaccurate reflections of who God is and how his world works. So, in short, as far as like the hair and the beard and everything, God's priests were not to offer up or drain themselves of the life force, whether blood or hair, because again, they can't cut the hair, they can't cut the beard, they can't cut themselves, which would again drain the life force of blood. They can't make themselves unwhole in this way, because it would make them unfit to return to service in his presence. And they were not to follow in the ways of the pagan priests, who sought to do these things in an attempt to appease, influence, or even manipulate their god. Because this is not how God has requested and commanded that access to him and communication with him works. Fourth and lastly, in this morning section, I want to give a brief aside concerning tattoos. I mentioned last week that I would get there this week. Why I have waited until this week is that this discussion here at the beginning of 21 helps us to better understand the reference back in 19, verse 28, about tattoos. Tattoos are not mentioned in our chapter today, as they are not part of the mourning process. This is also why 19:28 has the prepositional phrase. If you look there in 19, verse 28, it says, "You shall not make any cuts on your body for the dead or tattoo yourselves." Notice that "for the dead" is not after the tattooing. It is only after the cut yourselves. So again, the tattooing is not intrinsically related to the mourning process. But notice that the context in chapter 19 explicitly ties tattooing to other prohibited pagan rituals, such as drinking blood, interpreting omens, telling fortunes, rounding off or marring the hair or the beard, and making cuts on the dead. These last three of which we've just talked about how they're related to pagan rituals and practices about mourning. So tattooing, then, based on its context, we see that there is something inherently religious, specifically having to do with pagan rituals, as we have discussed, again, with these rituals that we're seeing today. So looking back, and thinking about tattooing and as it's grouped within its context, how does it relate to what maybe the pagans were doing around it? Tattooing in the ancient context seems to have been used as a mark, whether actually tattooed or just painted at times. The word can refer to both. And it was used to ward off evil spirits by showing, usually, the name or symbol of a god that the priest served or worshipped. So basically what you're saying is you tattoo, whether paint or mark yourself in some way, you're saying, I am claimed by this god. And because of that, when evil spirits are around me, they will see that and they will avoid me because they don't want to mess with that god. So it's kind of a ward that you put on yourself. This prohibition is given back in 19 because it not only applies to the priests, but also applies to the people in general, as they are not to use such markings as a charm or a ward. And they're obviously not to be marking themselves as a servant of a different god. God had already given the priests, especially the high priest, and the people approved attire and symbolic markings that showed which God they served. And it is he, not some symbol, that is greater than evil forces. This is the only explicit verse in the Bible concerning tattoos, so seeing and understanding its surrounding prohibitions shows us that we should understand it in context. Any logic we use to condemn tattooing, by and large, like to just condemn it in general, would also have to apply to prohibitions we see here, such as the ones having to do with shaving our hair or beard. Because, again, the semantic range of the hair and the beard, like you can't shave your head. So if we're going to condemn tattooing by and large, we also have to condemn shaving our hair and our beard by and large. The same logic would have to work because they're in the same context. Now, there is still room to discuss the wisdom and the motive of getting a tattoo. But that also applies to many other areas in which we allow personal freedom. What is explicitly prohibited here, in, again, the only reference to tattoos in the Bible, is getting a tattoo to worship another god or in belief that the tattoo will do something that God alone can do. So again, there is room for discussion about wisdom and maybe like your motive, like why are you doing it, what picture are you getting. But as far as like what's actually condemned with tattoos, the only thing that's actually condemned is doing it for the purpose of claiming or showing that you are worshiping a god other than God and using it as some sort of ward or charm to do something that God has promised that he is the one that does that. So that's just kind of an aside about tattoos. If you have more questions, you can talk to me later. But getting back to Leviticus 21, what is the messaging behind these restrictions about mourning? The priests, especially the high priests, were supposed to do everything possible to avoid becoming unclean through contact with the dead because God is life. In Eden was the tree of life. Death came after the fall. God's presence, the Holy of Holies, pictured Eden and was a beacon of hope that one day death would be no more. The tabernacle, specifically the Holy of Holies, was a visible step in God's plan to restore Eden and make all things new again. By having the priests gradually, based on their status, disassociate themselves from death, God was painting a picture of hope that one day death would be no more. The second message that we see in these chapters has to do with marriage and the priests. The priests, as we see in verse 7 and then verses 13 to 15, the priests were not allowed to marry a prostitute or a divorced woman, and the high priest must marry a virgin from his own tribe. There are a few quick things to note here as well. First, in verse 7, if you look there, it reads, "He shall not marry a prostitute or a woman who has been defiled, neither shall he marry a woman divorced from her husband." That's reading from the ESV. First part of the verse here, marry a prostitute or a woman who has been defiled, would be better translated as a woman defiled by prostitution, not a prostitute or a woman who has been defiled, as the two words are actually meant to convey one idea. And honestly, if you look at most of the translations, that's what they did with it. I'm not trying to pick on the ESV, by the way. Like, each translation has their section of the Bible where they just do weird things. The ESV just happens to be one that a lot of times in Leviticus just made some interesting choices that weren't all that helpful. So again, I'm not picking on the ESV as a whole. Like, I actually like the ESV. I use it a lot. But there are just certain verses where it's like, you could have made a better choice. So anyways, the prohibition there is against a woman who has made a habitual and intentional choice of immorality. So a woman who has defiled herself in this way is prohibited from marriage to a priest. But remember that Rahab was a prostitute, and yet is included in the lineage of Christ for her subsequent faith. And also remember that Jesus himself witnessed to multiple women who had committed adultery. This prohibition does not mean that moral failure, even prostitution, is unredeemable. It is another message about God, not the people, not the women. And then second, regarding the prohibition against marriage to a divorced woman, the only legitimate reason for divorce was supposed to be adultery. So the priests were not to marry a woman associated with the breaking of marriage vows. This also, by the way, helps explain Jesus' statement flashing forward in the Sermon on the Mount about divorce in Matthew 5:31-32, where he says, basically paraphrasing, "You have heard it say, that if a man finds an indecency in his wife, he can write her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, unless that be through sexual immorality, then he is causing her to commit adultery if she goes and marries somebody else. And I've always been kind of confused by that one, because you look at it and it's like, well, I mean, Paul and other people like add things about like different reasons why there can be a divorce. So why is Jesus only talking about that one? Well, he's doing it because he's actually specifically addressing a controversy that has to do with Deuteronomy 24:1, which is the verse that he cites. And in Deuteronomy 24:1, it says, a husband who finds some, basically any indecency in his wife, may write her a certificate of divorce. He has to go through a proper channel. He can't just like flippantly do it. But if he finds any indecency. And the controversy that came up over the centuries was that this verse had been broadened to really allow men to write a certificate of divorce for pretty much anything. Like, but they broadened indecency to pretty much anything he didn't like about her. He could just write her a divorce because he didn't like the way she talked to him, or like the way she did this, or whatever. It became a very flippant thing. And what Jesus is saying is, like, you've heard it say this. Like, this is how some people are currently teaching this. What I'm telling you is that the original intent of the verse was that it was only supposed to concern sexual immorality. That is what Jesus is doing in that verse. And getting back to Leviticus, the high priest is prohibited from marrying a widow, not due to any moral association, but simply because she is not a virgin. There's also, however, another probable message here, that the widow is associated with default by death. So again, it's kind of bringing association with death into the presence of God. So the priests, then, are not to marry anybody associated with habitual immorality, the breaking of marriage vows, or death. This is, again, not a statement about the prohibited women, but a statement about God, his created order, and his new creation that he is making, where there is no sin, no broken homes, no death. The third and final message in these chapters has to do with the acceptability of priests and the offering. 21:16-24 discuss things which permanently bar a priest from officiating the sacrifices. 22:1-9 discuss things that temporarily bar a priest from officiating. And then 22:17-25 discuss things that bar an animal from being an offering or sacrifice. Notice, ironically, that the list of things that permanently bar a priest are pretty much verbatim the list of things that bar an offering, which should tell you that, again, it is not a moral statement. That is not a moral statement about an animal that has a certain thing, and because of that, it's not allowed in God's presence. And just so, it is not a moral statement about the priests who happen to have this sort of handicap or deformity or whatever it is. The offerer and the offering are to be the best. But this is not a moral best. These priests are still allowed to eat priestly food, and they're allowed the priestly benefits. They are just barred from officiating in the tabernacle. The message is that God is to be associated, as we have seen already in Leviticus, with life and wholeness. There is nothing morally wrong with the priests who are unable to officiate, but their presence in the tabernacle would distort the image of Eden, old and new, that God is presenting to the people. The prohibitions were not designed to make certain people feel excluded or second rate. They were designed to give hope that one day their struggle would be over. One day there will be no more pain, no more handicaps. So what we see in these chapters, 21 and 22, these restrictions about mourning, about marriage, and about the acceptability of the offer and the offering, what we see is that God is using the priests to point the people to himself, to the world as he created it, and the work that he is doing to make all things new. One day, we will finally and perfectly be in God's presence, no longer seen through a veil, no longer demonstrated through the lives of just a few priests, but all of us, face to face with God. What the old covenant pictured through the priests, especially the high priest, Christ, the ultimate high priest, pictured with the multitudes who entered his presence. The sick and the disabled were healed, demons cast out, sins forgiven. All of these things that were pictured just through the restrictions of the priest became reality in miracles that Christ performed on those who entered his presence, just as the priests were entering God's presence in the Holy of Holies or the holy place. In the Old Covenant, in the tabernacle and later the temple, the priests were held to a higher standard to picture what living in God's presence meant. In the New Covenant, when God's presence, his Son, the new temple, walked among us, he spread this picture of life and healing everywhere he went and to everyone he taught. When Christ ascended, he then sent the Holy Spirit to indwell believers as the next temple, and the church was inaugurated through miraculous signs and wonders that gave this picture again to validate that the church, believers, are the new temple, this new picture of life in God's presence. We still see new signs and wonders today, especially where the church is spreading into unreached areas or where it is persecuted. Revelation 21 tells us that one day, the dwelling place of God will finally and perfectly be with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. The priests were restricted in their mourning, because one day there will be no mourning, no tears, no pain, no suffering. Some priests weren't allowed to officiate due to blemishes or handicaps because one day there will be no pain, no infirmity, no handicap. One day there will be healing. Certain practices and marriages weren't allowed due to association with pagan practices or immorality because one day we all will serve and worship God alone in a world without sin, without the curse. Revelation 21:5 says, "And he who is seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' And he also said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.'" Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you that as we work through these chapters, something that is seemingly unpleasant to read at first turns into a glorious picture of the hope that you give us that one day you are making all things new. That one day death will be no more. Suffering and pain and tears and sorrow, broken lives, broken families will be no more. That you are working to restore Eden and make a new earth where you will finally perfectly dwell with man, where we will see you face to face, no longer mediated through a priest. I thank you that we have this hope as we live in this world of darkness. And I thank you that you have given us certainty that this will be so, that you wrote these things down because they are trustworthy and true. And I thank you that as we dwell on them, as we find hope in them, that we are given the opportunity to encourage and to show others the light of your hope. And I pray that as we do so, that we will glorify you, that we will wonder how much you love us, that you have done this for us at the cost of your own, that you have made a way for this to be possible. Amen.